Up until about a year ago, the Muslim Student Association in North America had a page that answered the question, what is Islam? And it said very pointedly, Islam is not a religion. It's an all-encompassing ideology that incorporates politics, economics, law. It's a totalizing worldview. In fact, it's the only worldview because it's the one that's been given by the creator of the universe.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. We have a special guest in studio, Adam Francisco. He holds a DPhil in Islamic and Christian Relations from Oxford University and currently serves as professor of history at Concordia University in Irvine. He's a frequent contributor to Modern Reformation magazine and has served as one of the editors of Theologia et Apologia, Essays in Reformation Theology and Its Defense. Adam, thanks a lot for joining.
You're welcome.
So appreciative of the work that you've done, and it's not just sort of something on the side. You've done this as a research scholar. You continue to keep us informed about what Islam is and how to understand it, be ready to give answers for the hope that we have. The first question probably that a lot of people are asking is why you became interested in Islam in the first place.
It's sort of a long story, but I'll keep it short.
People can't see you. You're blonde, as blonde as they get. You don't look like you probably grew up in Pakistan.
I did not. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, which has actually a heavy concentration of Bosnian Muslims.
Huh.
Interestingly, I went to high school with a few of them. But my first real interest in Islam started probably in 1999, 2000, when I was working on a research project on Martin Luther and his view of the Turks. The Ottoman Turks were pushing up through Hungary during the heyday of the early Reformation. So I was doing this research and was accepted to study over at Oxford on this topic. And all of a sudden, as I'm prepping for making the trip over across the Atlantic, 9/11 happens. And all sorts of things started falling in place. The date, September 11th itself, is significant. September 11th, 1683, is the last jihad on Europe at the behest of the Ottomans. And so all these things started clicking, and I thought maybe I should look at this a little more broadly than just 16th century European-Ottoman relations.
So you studied at Oxford with the Center of Islamic Studies?
Yes, I was a member of Wycliffe Hall, which is an evangelical theological college connected to the university. Spent probably half my time at the Center for Islamic Studies, which is a center run by Muslims, funded by Muslims. It was a trial by fire in many ways. My supervisor, dissertation supervisor, is a high-profile scholar of Islam, probably the leading scholar on their equivalent to Thomas Aquinas or Martin Luther or John Calvin, a man named Ibn Taymiyyah, who's sometimes been called Al-Qaeda's philosopher. He put me through the ringer, and I'm extremely grateful for it because he never lied to me. He told me exactly what Muslims thought about the Quranic text or the particular passages of the Quranic text, schooled me in Arabic. I imagine he was hoping that something would click. In fact, he told me time and time again that by nature, I am a Muslim. I just don't realize it. And
because in Islam, we're all infidels, right? We've all apostatized from Islam. By nature, Muslims.
Right, right. And so if somebody enters Islam from some other position, it's not a convert to, it's a revert back to Islam. There is, in fact, a passage in the Quran. It's rather obscure, but it suggests that all people, before they're born at some place, and it doesn't give the details, were raised up into existence before Allah. And Allah says to them, will you take me as your Lord? And apparently everybody said yes. And so when we're born and we the initial months perhaps were considered Muslim, In the Muslim tradition, they will, in fact, one of the first things they'll do is whisper into a newborn's ear passages from the Quran in Arabic to awaken their intellect as to who they really are.
Hmm.
But as you go through life, the idea is that there are lots of distractions. Maybe you're raised by Christian parents or whatever. And so you cover over the truth of God as it's written on your heart, so to speak, and become an infidel. And the word for infidel is kafir, to cover over that truth.
Mm-hmm. So, for those who may not be familiar with Islam's history, could you give us a thumbnail sketch?
I could.
the very thumbnail sketch.
Historically speaking, in terms of the historical record, Islam begins, you could say, 610 AD. Muhammad's about 40 years old at the time. He's been, for the most part, involved in trading from his hometown of Mecca up to Syria, where he may have heard Christian claims, perhaps espoused by Nestorian Christians. At least that's the story or the tradition that's been passed down.
Which is where they get the errant view that Christians believe that Mary was also God and...
I think so, yes. Okay. Yeah. It's hard to prove that historically, yeah. But everything sort of lines up there. So he may have heard monotheistic claims, if we can put it that way, which certainly would have contradicted the claims he heard down in Mecca. The ancient Arabs before Islam were primarily polytheists. There were some Jews, but mostly Muhammad's kinsmen, the people who are part of his tribe, are all polytheists. They worship pretty much anything, stones, the moon, stars. In fact, Muhammad's tribe, it's said, was responsible for overseeing and keeping or maintaining the Kaaba, that square-like structure in Mecca today that's covered with a black covering. And allegedly in there were 360 idols that represented every god that was worshipped in the Arabian Peninsula. And every Arab tribe would annually visit that idol. And Muhammad's family would, of course, reap the benefits financially for that. And so as Muhammad's getting older, there's a turning point in his life. When he's about 25 years old, a very wealthy woman named Khadija proposes marriage to him. And who wouldn't take that offer? She's very wealthy and perhaps even attractive. And all of a sudden, he doesn't have to work so much anymore. And the way the biographical tradition puts it, he began making retreats just east of Mecca in this little mountain range and would hang out in a cave for hours, if not days on end, pondering the great questions in life. And I can't prove this, but I imagine the claims he heard up in Syria contrasted so remarkably from Meccan culture that maybe this contradiction was sitting at the front of his mind, and he pondered it deeply. Which religion is true, or what is the true God? Maybe that's giving him too much credit, but it's certainly feasible. And while he's in this cave, over 15 years, he never really reaches a conclusion until one night, it's said, on the ninth month of the lunar calendar, he starts to hear a voice. And later on, it takes about 3 years. He's a bit ambivalent at first. In fact, he thinks that maybe this voice is coming from the jinn, this bodiless spirits that sort of habitate the whole earth. He thinks that he's possessed by them. But after 3 years, he's finally convinced that that voice and the continual voices that he's hearing and the impressions he's getting in his mind are not the result of jinn toying with him, but rather it's Allah, the creator of the universe, who has been sending down his message using the angel Gabriel to him. And he takes the so-called prophetic mantle, 610 or 613 AD, and begins to preach to the people of Mecca. He becomes a warner to the people of Mecca. And from 610 to 622 AD, the message he delivers isn't all that profound. It's essentially, there is no God but Allah. All these idols you Arabs have been worshiping are all false. There's only one God. He is Allah. Allah is, in Arabic, simply means the creator or the God. It's not a personal name. And so after he starts preaching that there's only one God, he also attaches to it the claim that if you do not turn from your polytheism, you're going to spend an eternity in hellfire. And that's pretty much the core, theologically speaking, of what Muhammad preaches in Mecca. If you open up a Quran, which isn't put together chronologically, it's difficult to understand how this all unfolded unless you have a good Quran that tells you when the so-called revelations were given. It's not all that profound. It's basic monotheism, if you will. Things changed radically, though, around 622 AD. And in fact, that's the year Muslims claim or Muslims hold to be year one. So that's when Islam really begins. And that's when Muhammad moves from Mecca with maybe 100 followers who are, for the most part, persecuted in Mecca. Maybe not too heavily, but perhaps sometimes. There's a story in Islam that says some of them were, in fact, sent across the Red Sea to be taken care of by the Christian king of Abyssinia or Ethiopia. There's no historical evidence for this. It's simply a claim. But around 622, he gets the offer to come up to Medina, what will eventually be called Medina, and he's given political, military, and religious authority over the city. And in the Quran, these passages from this period, Islam is not altered. It just becomes much more pointed. It starts to define itself theologically, politically, and legally. And that's the Islam that we're very familiar with, I think. Not only the claim that there's no God but God, but Islam is the true continuation of the faith of Abraham, even the faith of Adam and all the prophets from the past. Jews and Christians, while they might claim to be monotheists, they have gone astray at some point over time, and so therefore are only loosely connected with the so-called Abrahamic tradition.
And mistranslations of the New Testament?
Mistranslations, corruptions.
A lot of this sounds like Mormonism. I mean, maybe not theologically, but the story, the plot line sounds a lot like a prophet out there in upstate New York, charismatic stage, and then he goes to Missouri and becomes his own mayor slash general slash pope of his own theocracy. That's the transition between Mecca and Medina?
Yeah, and you know, going back to Mormonism just a bit, I'm no expert on Mormonism, but did a bit of reading on it in years past, and I recall an early biography of Joseph Smith. I believe it's the Fawney Brody biography. At least one of the editions has Joseph Smith saying, "I'm going to do for America what Muhammad did for Arabia."
Interesting. Is there something to the claim that the Muhammad of Mecca is more open to, quote-unquote, people of the book, and the Medinan Muhammad is really what we know as Islam today?
Yes. Yes and no, actually. You probably don't like that sort of answer. The Quran is curious with regard to its treatment of Christianity. Some occasions it praises it or it holds it in high regard. Other occasions, Quran chapter 9, verse 29, enjoins Muslims to kill Christians and Jews if they don't submit to Islam, either as a faith or at least as a political and legal system by paying taxes, additional taxes and things. The Meccan passages on Christianity largely regard Christianity as an ally of Islam. Quran chapter 29, 46 has Muhammad, this is Meccan, has Muhammad telling what few followers he has, that when you come across the people of the book, Jews and Christians, do not deal harshly with them. Rather, tell them that their God and our God, their revelation and our revelation is one. Quran 109, everybody loves to quote this passage, especially the last verse, where Muhammad is responding to the Meccan elders who are saying, you know, tone down your preaching. It's upsetting the status quo. That's the context. And Muhammad says to them, well, you have your religion, I have mine. Lots of folks like that passage to assert that Islam is open to a pluralistic environment. It recognizes differences, but is comfortable living alongside polytheists or Christians or Jews. In fact, a book out there, I believe Oxford University Press published it, called The Islamic Roots of Democratic Pluralism. It's almost a laughable title. But the argument is based on this passage. It's not 18th, 19th century political developments in Western Europe where constitutionalism and a social contract and these sort of modern Western political values emerge. It's actually back in the 7th century down in Mecca. It's a fascinating book. Oh, it's silly, but fascinating at the same time. So you get this picture of Islam and its relationship with Christianity and even Judaism early on. But then you get these real strongly anti-Christian passages in the Medinan period. That's accounted for at least two ways. One school of Islamic thought would say the revelation that Allah sent down progresses. And early on, Islam, because it was persecuted by the Meccan elite, Allah saw that and knew it was in danger of becoming extinct. And so he allows for Muhammad and the Muslim community to look for allies. Later on, when he doesn't need them, though, he turns his back on them, the Jews especially, but also the Christians up in Medina. Another school of thought says that in the Quran, you get this contradictory picture of Christianity. The way to resolve it is there are at least two Christianities being talked about in the Quran. When it's positive towards Christianity, it's referring to what you and I would call heretical Christianity, maybe Arianism, perhaps Nestorianism, or some version of Christianity that perhaps was around in the Arabian Peninsula in the 7th century that did not confess creedal Christianity, regarded Christ perhaps as a prophet or as a prophet, but certainly not the divine Son of God. When the Quran speaks negatively of Christianity, it's referring to Orthodox, small o Orthodox or creedal Christianity.
Interesting.
And then there are lots of other positions as well. But those are the two prominent ones.
Because, of course, Arian, quote-unquote, Christians, not being Christian, Arians would have had a great deal of sympathy with some of Muhammad's concerns, right?
Absolutely. Now, I don't know if Arianism was down there. We don't know a whole lot about the Arabian Peninsula before the 7th century. That there just aren't any written sources minus a few fragments of poetry. Though some research has been done in the last 15 years, archaeological primarily, that is producing or finding evidence that there are these Arian-leaning Christian sects or a fusion, sort of like a Jewish Christianity down there that would have certainly downplayed or rejected the deity of Jesus, but maybe saw him as a prophetic figure.
So what do you say to people who basically every time you pick up the newspaper and read that Islam is a religion of peace, that what basically we're seeing in the news is an aberration? It's radical Islamists, not followers of Islam itself.
It depends what context I'm in. You got to be very careful. In fact, a colleague who teaches world religions at Irvine with me, we always talk about how difficult it is to talk about Islam these days because you want to tell the truth about Islam, but there's always somebody you're speaking to who's either a Muslim or has Muslim friends, and they don't get that you can talk about Islam as an ideological package or a worldview, but not necessarily suggest that every Muslim believes that. And so I always make a distinction. There is Islam, historic, classic Islam. That is, certainly has a propensity and oftentimes is violent, attempts to expand through aggressive force, oftentimes physical. Sometimes it's political persuasion, diplomacy. But more often than not, through the ages, it was through the military.
Because they don't distinguish between, you know, the kingdom of Allah and
right.
The it's all political.
It's a one kingdom theology, if you will,
as Christendom was in the same period, right?
Yeah. Well, yes.
I mean, some of this we're looking at our own debts, aren't we? In some sense, both of them were practicing a fusion of cult and culture, a fusion of Christ's kingdom on the Christian side with Europe and spreading Christian civilization through war.
Mm-hmm.
Not that, you know, there's an equivalence here.
Right.
But do you think that it's safe to say that Islam has always consistently practiced its faith when it does that and Christianity has diverged from the teaching of the New Testament when it practices that?
Yes. I think that's the distinction to make. that when Christianity is, when the two kingdoms are fused in some sort of Christian empire or what have you, that's an aberration. It's certainly not something validated or legitimized by Jesus or the biblical text, the New Testament. Whereas in Islam, it's designed to be, there is no separation of mosque or religion and state. It's all one thing. Muslims are very forthcoming about this. It used to be they took it down. But up until about a year ago, the Muslim Student Association in here in America or North America had a page that answered the question, what is Islam? And it said very pointedly, Islam is not a religion. It's an all-encompassing ideology that incorporates politics, economics, law. It's a totalizing worldview, if you will. In fact, and it goes on, it's the only worldview because it's the one that's been given by the creator of the universe. If I can get back just a bit to the question about Islam being a religion of peace, I do think there are Muslims out there. I think they're pretty small in number. We don't know the percentages who are working to transform Islam. They're seen by the greater Muslim community as turncoats, to be sure. But a man like Zudi Jasser out of Arizona was the major figure in this movie called the documentary called The Third Jihad, where he starts off by, you know, there are all these pictures of terrorism, and he's as he's narrating, he says, we all know about the war on terror. I'm going to tell you about the other war that's going on. And he's basically pulling the curtain aside, showing the cultural, what many are calling the cultural jihad going on. And he advocates a strong separation between religion and state for a more privatized, maybe a mystical version of Islam that really doesn't fit in mainstream Islam. But there are those Muslims out there who are doing that.
Is he Sufi?
I don't know if he would call himself Sufi, but he certainly leans that way. Mm. I don't know if he's heavily mystical, but usually those who want to separate from the more historical tradition fall into that camp. But Islam as an ideology has always, even today, even Muslims who are trying to make Islam mesh in the Western world admit this, that it historically has always seen the world as being comprised of two realms. There's the realm of Islam, where the population is majority Muslim. Most importantly, though, the government is Islamic and the laws are Sharia law. And everything outside of that in some way at some point is defined as the domain or realm of war or the realm of the struggle, the jihad, into which the domain of Islam is to expand through whatever means are appropriate. It might be through dawah, calling Christian nations to this, as Quran 3 puts it, this common word concerning the Abrahamic faith. And then all of a sudden, as this common word's established, the point should be made, the Quran goes on, that Islam is the true representative of the Abrahamic faith. Judaism and Christianity are deviations.
So step one is get people to say Islam is one of the three Abrahamic faiths. Step two is it is the true Abrahamic faith.
We're seeing that actually take place today. I don't know if you've heard anything about the common word discourse. That's exactly what's happening. But Islam can expand other ways, too. It could be in the old days when they had a significant army and they didn't have, especially in the 7th century, as the Eastern Roman Empire, Byzantium, had expended much of its military might against the Persian Empire at the time. Islam and its armies were quite significant, and they just rolled into Syria, the Holy Land, Egypt, and North Africa, eventually Spain. But if they can't compete militaristically with their neighbors, it's through political diplomacy or some other means.
It was reported a couple of weeks ago that in Switzerland, they have established their own parliament within Switzerland, the Umma Schweiz. The Islamic people will have their own parliament. Their own Sharia law will supplant the constitution of Switzerland. it's not just a matter of being anti-immigration. It's a question of whether Islam can live in a democratic state or whether over time you have this, look, we can compromise for a time. Then the next stage is we set up our own government within a government. And then the next stage, finally, is that over time, and it may take centuries, but over time, we will completely Islamicize that nation. Is that conspiracy theory? Is that?
Well, it sounds like it.
And it does.
But and I don't know if.
But historically, it seems to have gone that way.
And that's, Islam is a supremacist ideology. The telos, the end, is Islamization, not just in, and actually, historically, Muslims don't care so much about what every individual thinks about God and how they worship. What they're concerned primarily about is the political establishment and the law. And everything else is a distraction. I do think, while it does sound conspiratorial, and one wishes we could get evidence of these backroom meetings, and there are reports, especially amongst missionaries who worked in Islamic countries in decades past, that these things actually did take place. I've never had anything put in my hand, though. Tariq Ramadan, oftentimes called the Martin Luther of Islam, he's the grandson of the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hmm. Born and raised in Switzerland, very articulate, speaks several languages fluently, was for a while a professor at Oxford, then went to the Netherlands, now is back at Oxford. He was in, I think, 2005 or 2006, invited to become a professor of peace studies at University of Notre Dame in Indiana. And when he, after he packed up the house, got everything set up for his children here in the U.S. in Indiana, went to get his visa and was denied. The first justification was he had, his ideology was just too hostile or inimical to American context or something like that. Huh. Then when that was found to be problematic or overturned, the State Department went digging and found that he had given, I think, a little over $1,000 to an Islamic charity that in turn that money over to Hamas. Hmm. And so they were able to keep him from entering the U.S. until about a year and a half ago. The State Department under new leadership issued a sort of unilateral decree that said he will be allowed in the U.S. And he's been popping back and forth from Oxford to America. But he wrote a book published 2005 or so called Western Muslims and the Future of Islam, which is essentially a text on how Muslims need to reconsider Islam in this new context, reconsider classic Orthodox Islam, how they can negotiate a Western secular environment and still be authentically Islam. Mm-hmm. And he argues that till this point, and even to this day, Muslims see the world in this sort of bifurcated picture, the domain of Islam and the domain of war. And historically, he says that's the way we could envision the world because there were Muslim governments. Today, in fact, since the end of the Ottoman Empire, he says there's no real Muslim government. There are places that keep up appearances. Maybe part of the Sharia informs the legal code, but there's no one state that has a 100% pure Islamic law in place and has a Islamic government that defends the integrity of Islam that is not in bed with Western powers and so on. Hmm. So he says there is no domain of Islam, so there can't be a domain of war. Maybe the whole world, as the real hardcore Islamists would put it, is the domain of war, the domain of the struggle. But he says maybe we should see the world as the domain of shahada, the domain of testifying to Allah. That is, Muslims, wherever they find themselves, in the sort of apostate Muslim world, under these secular military presidents and others that are now most of them are being removed from office through the Arab Spring, whether it be there or in France or England or America, the whole world is a domain where we're to testify to Allah and testify to the integrity of Islam. And he doesn't spell it out, but what he's driving at is we need to start over again. And in many ways, he doesn't use the terminology, but it's very, to me at least, and to several scholars or analysts, it's pretty clear he's sort of softened the ideology or the rhetoric of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood's main platform, as it was advocated by Said Qutb, was that the whole world is in a state of jahiliya, of ignorance, much like it was at the time just before the arrival of Muhammad. And so it's like the Muslim Brotherhood and Tariq Ramadan today and these sophisticated Western Islamists who aren't violent necessarily. Ideologically, though, they have a solid Islamist ideology. They're saying we need to start over again. The Muslim world's failed. The Western world obviously is, because it's influenced by secular or Judeo-Christian thought, is in a state of ignorance as well. So Islam can begin anew wherever, anywhere. And the principles that we should use, Ramadan argues, for reconstructing Islam are the principles we've had all along. He says in a very memorable line to me that the principles in the Quran and the tradition of Muhammad, that the hadith and the biographical literature, are principles that cut across all time and all frontiers. That line in that book is, for my two cents, is indication that he's not advocating a moderation of Islam at all. He's advocating a reconstruction that will take time. But Muslims are, because they're ambassadors for Allah, if you will, are to take part in this, if they're really Muslim.
Interesting.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.